welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 270 of the podcast, and it is the 23rd of May, 2016, as I record this. So today I have an interview with Libby Hawker, and we have a really awesome chat about methods for outlining and also talk about writing literary fiction quickly and different aspects of ambition. And this was a lot of fun, so I think I'll definitely have to have Libby back on the show because we really got on well. So good show coming up. My update is that I have almost finished the first draft of the author mindset book. I did massive amounts of wrangling last week because basically I went through all my journals over the last sort of 10 years and typed up a whole load of, things that I found in it. And so I've included some of those sort of bits of the diary, but also just, you know, tons and tons of notes that I then had to wrangle. So I kind of didn't write it from scratch. Like I had a load of notes and then I rewrote those notes. So I think that actually took longer than it should have done for such a short book. I actually think it will only be around 40,000 words. So because I don't want it to be really heavy, I just want it to be, look, these are the things that you're going to face or that you have faced or you are facing, and these are all entirely normal. So thank you again for all of those of you who've emailed me or tweeted me and said, please finish the book because it seems like this is really need it. So my aim is, well, I have to have it with my nonfiction editor, Liz, by the 31st of May. So that's next week. And then I want to get the ebook print and audiobook out at the same time. So probably will be the end of June. I also have a short story to write for Kobo in the next month, a few weeks, and also a screenplay to write because I've booked myself on a screenplay editing course in about 2 weeks' time and I haven't actually written it yet. Luckily, I can at least have a go at an adaptation first draft, and it shouldn't take too long, so that's a plan. Also, I was at Crime Fest this last weekend in Bristol, and it's really amazing how much the attitude has changed there since I first attended 4 years ago. And when I first went, I felt very marginalised as an indie, and there were, no indies were on any panels, and it was, pretty dire. But 4 years later, I've been now presenting a teaching an hour on self-publishing at the fair. Plus, I was on a normal panel alongside traditionally published authors on the topic of international settings, and there was no mention at all of my method of publishing, and there were a number of other indie authors on other panels where there was no mention of them being indie. And I think that is my aim, is to for us to participate in festivals and in events where, the way we put our books out is unimportant because readers don't care. So why would you at a literary festival discuss method of publishing? It's just not necessary. But saying that, there was also an indie panel. So this was the third year this happened. And in the past, it's been a sort of emerging voices title of the panel, because the assumption was that only people who couldn't get a contract would be going indie, so therefore we were emerging voices. Last year, I think those of us on the panel, it included people like Mel Sherritt and Nick Stevenson and Selena Grace and a whole load of other people who, between us, I think we sold over 1 million books, and it was kind of, this is not an emerging voices type thing. And this year, what was fantastic is Rachel Abbott, who is, if you're in the UK, you've probably heard of Rachel Abbott. If you aren't, she's sort of one of the top 20 best-selling authors in the whole UK, not just crime authors, but, best-selling authors, alongside people like Peter James, Karen Slaughter, and other people who are, Jeffrey Archer, people like that. So she's doing incredibly well. Rachel is a,
positive indie choice, has kept her rights in the UK and is doing incredibly well. She was on the panel, and also Zoe Sharp, described by Lee Child as the female version of him, and you know, very again popular action, female action writer. And so both of those were, Zoe actually chaired the panel and Rachel was on it along with some other people, and it was awesome. So I'm really pleased that, and they also, they changed the name. They changed the name. It's not emerging writers. I think it's called the Indie Alternative now. So what I just wanted to kind of report back on is, you know, and I had a great time. I actually really enjoyed Crimefest. I have more of a network of authors now. And, you know, increasingly I find that there is no judgment of my method of publishing. So yeah, I just wanted to report that in the UK, which is, let's say, a bastion of literary snobbery in the world, you can sort of bypass that. And yeah, so all good. In publishing news this week, probably the most interesting thing is the announcements coming out of Goodreads. So there are two things. They're introducing Goodreads deals and email newsletter to people who can opt in. So it's not everyone on Goodreads, but you have to opt in, which will tell them about sales or reductions in books on their to-be-read list. So this could potentially be expanded into something like BookBub. Now, it's not open to submissions, but they're in, you know, obviously they will look at what they're going to do with that and see what they will do. But essentially, if you can get your book on people's to-be-read list, that is going to be a way to be part of their newsletter at some point. And they've also recently announced Goodreads ebook giveaways, which is in beta. And so, you know, for years now, Goodreads have enabled print giveaways, and but they will be doing ebook giveaways. So currently that's curated, invite only, probably merchandised, probably for traditional publishing. But you never know, they probably will open it up to everyone. Goodreads, of course, is owned by Amazon, and you know, I would see this as a big deal. This has been noted as related to the sort of shutting down of Fussy Librarian, who've been pinged for their newsletter using affiliate codes. Now, it would be, I mean, basically Amazon could shut down a lot of these different services by changing their, not changing their terms and conditions, because the terms and conditions actually say you can't share affiliate links in emails, although pretty much everyone does. And it hasn't really been enforced. Now they're starting to enforce it. So this is a really interesting development. I am interested. I mean, I've continued to use Goodreads for years. I use it as a reader. I log the books I read there. I also do giveaways. And the good thing about doing a print giveaway is that people who enter your competition, I either automatically or can, you know, more easily add your book to their to-be-read list. So the more you do competitions, the more your book ends up on these to-read lists, the more that goes into the recommendation algorithms on Goodreads. And there is a very big community there, so of readers, which is very important. So yeah, I'm very positive about this. These developments with Goodreads, I think it's a good site. I don't see it going away. It's the best one to use. The app is great. Yeah, very happy with that. Okay, so we'll see. I'll obviously keep an eye on what's happening, and hopefully that will all open up to indies in the coming months. Okay, a very cool thing on Facebook advertising. I will be doing two free webinars with Mark Dawson on Facebook advertising and using Facebook to grow your email list, sell more books, and also, I guess, a discussion on what's working right now in Facebook advertising. And we're doing two webinars because last time we did this, they were completely kind of oversubscribed. So you have two choices, either Sunday 5th of June or Thursday 9th of June, and that will be at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. UK, or you can sign up and get the replay, and we will be doing sort of 45 minutes, 50 minutes of real content, high value content, which will mean you will be able to implement you know, some basic ads immediately, or you'll be able to improve what you've already got, you know, revisit the basics. We'll also be doing a live Q&A, and those of you who've come along to webinars I've done before know that we have a lot of fun, actually. I really look forward to doing them because I get to you know, I sit in the chat and chat with everyone, and then we have the live Q&A after. So come and join us. So you can sign up at thecreativepen.com/Facebook1, and that will be the 5th of June webinar, or thecreativepen.com/Facebook2. And that will be the 9th of June webinar. And those links are also on the show notes, but basically Facebook 1 or Facebook 2. And yeah, I hope you'll come along with that. I'm very excited. I always learn something. And of course, Facebook advertising is changing all the time. So it will be good to get up to date. I'll also be having Mark on the podcast coming up. But of course, on a podcast, there's no Q&A and you can't ask your questions. So hopefully you'll come and join us on the webinar. So thanks as ever for your emails and tweets. Always lovely. Here's a selection. Mark Noldy says, listening to the show while I mow the lawn. I think we have a lot of lawn mowers going on here. Diana Anderson Tyler says, binge listening to the Creative Pen podcast. I always enjoy it when people binge to catch up. There's quite a lot to catch up on now. Suki Jutla says, with Lisa Congdon, another great episode full of inspiration. I love the long intro. Thank you both. Thanks, Suki, because yeah, it was pretty long last week. I'm going to try and keep it snappy this week. Bradley Charbonneau, listening to your audio tips while packing to move to Europe from California, and sent me a picture of packing boxes. Yeah, that's a hardcore move. I've done the England to New Zealand, New Zealand to Australia, Australia back to the UK. It all involves a lot of moving stuff. AR Robinson, or at Love God Tattoos, one of my favourite Twitter handles, says, very inspirational introduction. Really enjoyed the parallels of walking and Picasso, but why Flickr and not Instagram? And I wanted to answer this question. I did reply, but, you know, the choice of, I share, if you didn't get last week, I share my photos on Flickr. So I share albums of my travels and things on Flickr, and I post that on my, you know, my Facebook page and all that. But I use Flickr, well, firstly, because I've been using it for years before it came out, before Instagram. Secondly, Instagram, you only kind of share one picture at a time, it seems. Whereas Flickr, you can upload sort of 50 photos at once and put them in an album and share the album. You can also embed it. Also, I do Creative Commons. So I essentially have enabled people to use my pictures. So you're welcome to use my pictures on Flickr, and they have Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial license, which means you can use them as long as you link back to me, and also you don't use them, say, for a book cover to make money with, but you can use them on your blog, you can, you know, do whatever you like as long as you're not making money. So that is why I use Flickr. I think it's really good to remember that not everything has to be instantly shareable. I mean, you can do that on Flickr, but yeah, I use it for more, you know, sort of keeping all my photos that are for public consumption in one place. Lex Duncan says, studying for my final math exam while listening to the show. Wish me luck. Math is the worst. And sent a picture of algebra. Now, Lex, I do wish you well, but I just don't know how you're doing algebra while listening to the show. So all the best. Jennifer Aramiva, what takes the sting out of kitchen cleanup? A fresh episode of The Creative Pen. And bravely sent a picture on Twitter of a very messy kitchen. Gabrielle Garvin. Oh, and this was a separate tweet, but it says, Gabrielle says, I found a super editor on your website a few days ago. I'm so excited. I now actually feel like a real writer. And I wanted to share that as I'm, you know, I sort of get this question several times a day. You can find the list of editors at thecreativepen.com/editors, and also /book cover design and /formatters if you need those types of resources. So thanks as ever for your emails, comments, tweets about listening to the show. I really enjoy getting them. So please keep sending them. And I generally like, follow back on Twitter. And it just makes me feel happy that you enjoy the show so much that you let me know where you are and what you're doing while listening to the show. All right, so this podcast episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and a word from our sponsor very soon. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks especially to new patrons, Diana Tyler, Barbara Burgess and Jamie Crumpton. And I met Jamie in Austin. So, and we had a taco. I had my first shrimp taco with Jamie. Thank you for introducing me to those. Very good. I really do appreciate your Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It really demonstrates that you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And if you'd like to support me with even just a few dollars on Patreon, less than a coffee a month, you will also get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be recording in the next 48 hours for those of you who are Patreon supporters. And you'll also get the last 6 months worth of extra Q&A to download. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, so let's hear from Kobo and then we'll be into the interview.
Hey, Creative Pen fans, this is Camille Mofidi, the European manager for Kobo Writing Life based in Paris. Did you know you could publish and sell your ebooks very easily all over the world with Kobo, reaching an international audience in 190 countries? Plus, you can now benefit from two brand new features on our website, readers' reviews and series numbers that will help raising awareness and visibility for all your books. For more details, please visit our blog www.kobowritinglife.com, where these features are fully presented. Thank you for listening, and now back to your wonderful host, Joanna.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Livvy Hawker. Hi Livvy.
Hi, how are you?
I am good and very excited to have you here today. Just a little introduction. Livvy writes historical and literary fiction featuring complex characters and rich details of time and place, including an awesome series about ancient Egypt, which is one of my own obsessions. So very exciting. And Livvy is well known in the author community for her books for authors, including Gotta Read It about book descriptions, Take Off Your Pants about outlining, as well as Making It in Historical Fiction. So Livvy, let's just start by you telling us a bit more about you and how you got into writing.
Sure. First of all, I have to apologize for my echoey sound, which anybody who's heard me on a podcast recently is familiar with by now. Unfortunately, my office is in a very, very old building and it does not have good soundproofing. So we just have to deal with me echoing. I have been writing full time for about two and a half years now. Before that, I wrote my first novel, beginning it in late 2008. I finished it up in 2009. And then I went from there and actually found a literary agent. I worked with agents for 2 years, but never saw any gains from that, unfortunately. So I transitioned over to self-publishing in 2011, and I've been very happy with it ever since. And in more recent years, in 2014, I was approached by a few publishers to talk about potentially contracting some of my historical fiction. And I ended up working with one of those publishers on three novels so far. May sell them some more in the future, we'll see. And then I'm also in talks with a separate publisher at the moment now for a totally different literary novel that I'm working on. So That's my career in a nutshell.
And what did you do before you were a writer?
Oh, God, it's almost easier to say what I didn't do. I only ever wanted to be a writer, so I have had a wide variety of jobs. I took whatever job I could find and that would allow me to pay the bills and would also give me some reasonable time to write in the evenings. So I have worked at everything from, I used to train show dogs and handle show dogs in the ring, did that for a while. I was a zookeeper for a couple of years, which was interesting. Sorry, I've got my notifications going off here too. Go away. Ignore the dinging and the echoes. I worked for my sister's yarn business for a while, so I dyed yarn, which was also kind of fascinating. And my most recent job before I started writing full-time was I had a lot of kind of interesting and varied involvement in the veterinary industry, and I'm actually working on a memoir about part of that work, where I spent a year working the overnight shift in an emergency vet clinic. So I've had a lot of weird experiences.
Wow, that's really cool. But I think this is a really good point because, you know, so many people kind of expect to start writing their first book and then go full time as a writer.
Right.
Whereas you spent presumably, so you've been writing all that time. So it wasn't like your first novel in 2011, you self-published and you gave up your job.
No, although my first novel, which I did end up self-publishing, has ended up kind of being like the mainstay for my career. But that was the first novel I finished. Like, I'd started a lot of really crappy novels in the years before that. Never did anything with them. I didn't really know what I was doing. And I didn't have, you know, the drive and the motivation at that time to like really see a project all the way through and finish it. I was very much into that floaty, like, follow your muse thing, which doesn't work for a career, sadly. It'd be great if it did. So I wasn't really writing with much focus and discipline. And when I finally put in the hours and really got serious about finishing a novel, to my pleasant surprise, it was a pretty well-liked novel that readers have tons of readers who find my books through that first book. So that's pretty exciting to see it still succeeding and doing well for me.
You should really tell us the title of that book.
Oh, it's called The Sekhmet Bed. It's actually, I don't know when this podcast is going to air, but it's going to be 99 cents through the end of May. So if you want to check it out, now's a good time.
That's fantastic. And that's one of the Egyptian ones, right?
Yeah, it's the start of a 4-book Egyptian series. And then since then, I've actually written a totally separate Egyptian series as well. So I've got 2 of them now. The second series is considerably more dark. It's a few different people have likened it to Game of Thrones in ancient Egypt. And I definitely Ooh. Would have to agree with that because pretty much everyone gets killed. Spoiler alert.
That sounds awesome.
It's pretty fun. But, you know, as I like to say in my defense, don't blame me, blame history. I'm just following the historical record here.
Well, yeah, let's face it, everybody dies
sooner or later. Just or you know later. Not everybody's lucky enough to die as spectacularly and as frequently as people died in Amarna era Egypt, so this is a pretty hardcore series. It's fun.
So on that, you talked a bit about finishing energy, and that I think it's something that is not appreciated so much. But I actually had an email from someone this week, and she said, I've just started like 7 different things and I just can't finish them. So what was the thing that pushed you over the line? And what is that? How can other people take that finishing energy and you know, how can people find that, I guess?
Yeah, great question. First of all, I mean, I think once you finish one book, it gets considerably easier to get to that point with subsequent books. And then the more books you finish, the easier it gets to get there. So now I'm at the point where I can finish like a whole big, you know, a good sized novel, 130,000 words or whatever in a month. It just becomes less of an issue once you push yourself through that first 1 or 2 books and like really make yourself focus. But what did it for me is that, you know, growing up as a kid, when I was like 8 years old, I knew I wanted to be a writer for my job. And I was 28 and I was like, you know, I've spent the last 20 years thinking about how I want to be a writer, but I'm not really doing much to actually get myself there. So my goal was, maybe a little naive at the time, but my goal was that I wanted to be working as a full-time writer by the time I turned 30, which was only 2 years away. So I had to really get my butt in gear, make it happen. It turned out it took me till I was 34 to actually get to the point where I could work as a full-time writer, but you know, that's pretty close. So I'm not going to be too hard on myself for that.
So I think then, same with me, it was setting a deadline. Like my deadline when I was writing was I wanted to have this by my birthday the following year. And it was about 14 months or something, you know, when I decided, and I missed it, but like you, I missed it, but I only missed it by about a month and a half. But is the deadline the number one thing people need, really?
I feel like definitely that plays a big part for a lot of people. I mean, some people just really don't care about deadlines, and even if they set deadlines for themselves, they aren't going to stick to them. But if you're at all motivated by something kind of having an expiration date on it, you know, I think it can help a lot. Even if it's just kind of an arbitrary deadline, like I want to have a book finished in a year or in 6 months or whatever, kind of setting that goal for yourself and then giving yourself that accountability of kind of looking at the calendar every day and being like, how much closer am I to reaching this goal? Oh, not at all. Well, I guess I need to work extra hard today. I think that helps a lot.
Yeah.
One thing that has really helped me a lot in more recent months is there's this really cool date planner called a Spark Notebook. This woman invented them, and she, you know, put up like a GoFundMe to get them started. A friend of mine has been using it. It's really neat. It's kind of a different kind of planner where you actually write goals for yourself for the week, and then it has pages in it where you're supposed to go back over your goals and review them in really specific terms and like sort of talk to yourself about how you did in terms of keeping, you know, to those goals. So it's pretty cool. It's a nice little nice little thing to use.
That's great. And yeah, I think the point there is it doesn't really matter what you use, but you have to use something in order to keep yourself going to that goal. And I guess one of the other things as a segue is outlining, which, you know, you've written a book about. So first of all, what is that title about? Take Off Your Pants.
Oh, Take Off Your Pants. The book that sells purely because of its title.
People think it's a romance.
I have actually had people ask me to write one specifically about romances, so I'm working on that for the future. But Take Off Your Pants is, you know, that title and the book came about because, of course, anybody who spends any time on writing forums is familiar with the age-old question that always comes up like once a week on every writing forum. Are you a plotter or a pantser? And, of course, pantsing means, do you fly by the seat of your pants? Do you just make something up as you go along without any kind of prearranged plan? So I wanted to write this book because I was receiving a lot of questions, also like you have from that person who reached out to you, receiving a lot of questions from people asking how they could basically get to the point where I was, where they started writing full time, what it took to like sustain a full time writing career in today's writing market, and how they could make that happen, basically. And the advice I kept giving over and over again was, you need to outline your books before you write them. You have to have kind of a blueprint for your book, like something that shows all of its structure and that you can kind of use to sort of visually check that all the components are going to work together well before you start writing. Because I know, like with me, with my first book I wrote, it turned out well, but it took, you know, a year to get there. And I ended up adding a lot of extraneous stuff that really didn't need to be there. It wasn't supporting the story. You know, and I wrote off into corners sometimes, and I would have to go back and delete like a week's worth of work, which was disheartening because, you know, those weeks, that was tough. I was still working at full-time jobs. I only had a couple hours a day to write. So those couple of hours per day were really precious to me. And to delete the work I'd done in that time felt like, you know, it was a big setback. It didn't just feel like a setback. It was a setback. Mm. And it made it a lot harder and took a lot longer for me to finish that book and the next book I wrote, which was also not outlined. So in order to get the kind of speed of production that you need in order to sustain a writing career, whether you're working with traditional publishers or whether you're self-publishing or, you know, splitting the difference, you need to have a lot of books coming out, whether they're under all one pen name or different ones, it doesn't matter, but you need a lot of books. And you have to be able to know that you can produce books on a fairly tight timeline and get them out really reliably so that you can stick to a production schedule. So that's what Take Off Your Pants is about. It's an outlining method that works really well for me and that helps me sort of ensure that I am putting together a book that's going to be compelling and tightly paced and satisfying to readers before I even waste any time writing it.
Right. So you mentioned there sort of an outline of the book on outlining, but can you give us what is briefly the three-legged outline that you talk about?
Yeah, sure. So the three-legged outline is three kind of separate components that you sort of bring together and like can visualize it as like a tripod that supports the rest of your story. So those three legs of that outline are the character arc, the theme of the story, and the pacing. You know, how quickly the story moves and how tightly it all sort of funnels together. And those are, in my opinion, those are the things that make for really compelling storytelling. And of course, the plot's like not involved in that because plot is by itself not as compelling as, you know, what a character goes through, what they face, and how quickly you end up turning those pages.
Yeah, and I wanted to specifically ask about character. Obviously, we can't talk about everything in detail, but one of the things that, and I'm kind of a cross between, I guess, pantser and plotter, I think about things a lot, and then I come up with about three or four big scenes. Like, I always know the ending and the beginning scene and a couple in the middle, and then I just start writing, so it kind of emerges. And what kind of annoys me about a lot of outlining stuff on character is, oh, you must write 20 pages of sort of character Q&A and get to know your character, and none of that will go into the book. And I'm like, no, that's a waste of time. Yes. So what do you mean by the outlining of the character in particular?
Yeah, I agree with you that I think kind of like writing up a big long bio for your character is pretty much a waste of time. I don't think you need to know a character in that kind of depth and that kind of detail in order to write them in a compelling way. I think the main thing that makes a character interesting is for the reader to perceive from early on in the story that they have a serious problem that they need to solve. The character, not the reader. Hopefully their problem is not reading your book, if the reader has a problem at all. They need to be able to tell early on and to understand very clearly that there's something going on with this character, not just sort of the external thing that they want to go out and get for themselves, but there's something inside them personally that needs to be fixed. That's what makes them so interesting and so compelling. And it's really the basis of, you know, mythology. And it's a common theme that is shared in among stories from all different cultures that you know, anthropologists and folklorists have collected. That idea of a character who is screwed up somehow and has to sort of go on a quest, either external or internal, in order to be not screwed up by the end. that's kind of what story is, really, in a nutshell. So rather than focusing on, you know, where your character went to college and what their job is and what they think about their mom and dad, you know, those things don't typically have any bearing on the story at all. If they do have bearing on the story, great, you should iron those things out, but they usually don't. And they're not going to get you any closer to finishing a book. So I personally view them as maybe not the wisest use of one's time, but that's my opinion.
No, I agree. And this is the problem with the headset thing. Now I'm echoing, but it sounds like it's gone. So one of the things on that is the kind of the things that go in the outline. Do they all go in the story? Is it also formulaic? What about my creative process? So, you know, does the outlining process make things formulaic, basically?
Only in the sense that virtually all stories follow the same kind of formula. It's a real basic formula that I also talked about in my other book about writing product descriptions. It's, you know, this is at the heart of almost every compelling story we have ever, you know, kept in the human record since time began, which is basically these five little simple chunks. You have a character who wants something, but something stands in their way. So they struggle against that force to get what they want, and they either succeed or they fail. That's what a story is, basically, you know, in its most elemental form. So the outlining method that I detail in this book does follow that kind of formula. But as you can see, the formula is broad enough that there's almost endless possibilities for interpretations on it and for variations that make your book feel really unique and different.
Mm. And then the other thing you mentioned earlier, you actually said very offhand, 130,000 words in a month. So how does the outline help you write at speed?
The main way it helps me write at speed is by ensuring that I produce really clean drafts. So even if I'm, you know, I could sit there and hammer out 200,000 words, and if I can't use any of them in that story, it's kind of wasted time and effort, you know? So by ensuring that I'm able to focus narrowly on what matters to the story, what belongs in this story via that outlining process, I'm able to put all 130,000 words or however much I write in there to effective use within the story. Like, they're almost certainly not going to be edited out later. I probably won't have to add anything in order to bridge any gaps that might be missing. Sometimes I do. My editors are good about catching that stuff. But typically, you know, the outlining process produces a full, complete story from the beginning, from the planning stage, so that I know I can just follow that roadmap I've laid out for myself, write through it, flesh out all those scenes, and I've got a complete, functional, compelling, satisfying book when I'm done.
But then, you know, I want to say Dean Wesley Smith said this, is writing is not just typing. You know, as in, yeah, sure, you typed 130,000 words in a month, but what about the thinking process? Like, you write historical fiction. So what is your research process and the time you spend on thinking and planning before you do the outline? So, you know, how do you do that, especially with historical fiction, which is heavy on the research?
Yeah, it's very heavy on the research. And if you don't get the facts right, or at least explain why you deviated from facts, reviewers and readers are not happy about that. So you have to be careful about it. Typically for me, I have a lot of ideas that are always kind of percolating about future books I might like to write. So when I know that I have one coming up in the future, like, oh yeah, I want to do this book on Pocahontas at some point in the nearish future or whatever, I'll start reading the research material for that during my free time. So when I'm not writing, I'm just reading and absorbing that stuff and just getting it all kind of inside my head. Then if I'm at the point where I can successfully write an outline that gets me all the way to the end of a book planning wise, like with this outline structure, then I know I've read enough research material that I can actually start writing that book. Of course, like once in a while, you have to pause while you're typing and look up stuff and verify details and, you know, put some color in. That's to be expected. But yeah, like once I've observed enough research information that allows me to plan that book all the way through to its end, then I know I've done enough reading. It's time to stop reading and it's time to start writing. So that's kind of how it works for me. I guess I sort of compartmentalize my thinking about a project and sort of mentally planning what it's going to be like, and then actually doing the time at the keyboard to produce it, whether that time is outlining or writing the words.
Okay. And so how long does the outline take to create, if you, you know, it's sort of from first gestation idea through to when you've got a finished outline? Or I guess it will vary depending on the project.
Yeah, it really varies a lot depending on the project and on how much research I had to do in order to get to that point. When I write about Egypt, for example, I'm such a fan of Egyptology that I can write it pretty fast. Like I have a lot of Egypt facts already crammed into my brain. So like, you know, I know the 18th dynasty backwards and forwards. I can just sit down and outline, you know, and you can give me any character's name if they were reasonably well known and well documented from 18th dynasty. I can put together a pretty believable historical novel on them in, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours. But if I'm writing in a setting that's less familiar to me and that's going to take more time to learn about and to kind of stick into my brain, it could take a couple of months of reading before I get to that point. But I'm working on other writing projects. In the meantime, the reading is something that's, again, it's when I'm in bed going to sleep. It's when I'm taking a bath. I've got my Kindle in a plastic bag and I'm, you know, reading on that. When I'm on the ferry going to the mainland, that's kind of my reading time too. So reading time is very separate from writing time for me.
Ooh, where do you live?
I live in Friday Harbor, Washington. It's on an island. It's about an hour's boat ride from the mainland. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And I just interested in your historical research. So do you take notes from Kindle books, for example, you mentioned there, or do you travel, or do you go to museums? Like, how do you do your research into Egypt or other things?
I would love to be able to travel to do all this research. I would absolutely love it. I haven't had the means to do it so far. And right now I don't have the time. Like, now as soon as I've gotten enough money that I can travel, I'm like, oh, I'm so busy writing, I can't leave my office. So I haven't done a lot of traveling yet, unfortunately. Most of my research is done just through reading. I watch a lot of documentaries if I can find good documentaries on the subject. Sometimes they're a little iffy. But I do a lot of that. I had the fortune recently, I've got a new novel coming out on May 10th called Mercer Girls, which is about historic Seattle and an interesting sort of mail order bride plot that was enacted to try to bring women into Seattle because there were just too many guys everywhere, a huge sausage fest. I wrote a novel about that, which was really fun, but I didn't know much about it, so I had to do a lot of research for that. And for that one, I actually was able to meet with some historians, some local historians, and talk to them about the subject and see some of the notes they'd collected on it and stuff, which was really cool. I really enjoyed that experience. And I hope I'm able to do more kind of hands-on research for future historical novels, but it sort of depends where they're set and whether I can travel there easily. Like, obviously, my recent novel about ancient Syria, not going there. Unfortunately.
No. No, although they've reconstructed the Arch of Palmyra in Trafalgar Square.
I'm so glad. I was so upset about that because that's where my book was set, was in Palmyra, and I was like, oh,
I know. It's so funny, isn't it? Well, it's not funny at all, but I put it in Destroyer of Worlds. I had one of my characters kind of upset about the destruction in Palmyra. It's so funny how all these things work together. But just to also come back on the speed and quality, because amazingly still people have a resistance, writers have a resistance about quality and speed. Mm-hmm. And you write fast, but you also write literary fiction, which many people would say, no way. How can you write a fast literary fiction novel? So tell us your thoughts on speed and quality.
I don't at all think, of course, I mean, I'm a little biased, but I do not think that that speed and quality are mutually exclusive. In fact, some of the best, you know, most highly respected authors out there have written some very highly respected novels very, very fast. I don't remember off the top of my head exactly how long it took Cormac McCarthy to write The Road, but it was a matter of weeks, not months, and definitely not years. So that's one example. there are all kinds of other examples out there. Was it Kurt Vonnegut who said first thought, best thought? I mean, you know, a lot of literary novelists have espoused this idea for a long time that that the best thing you can do when you're writing a highly emotionally invested work, such as a literary novel, is to go with your gut feeling on it and to just express whatever is kind of coming through you at the time. So I think kind of the key to writing literary fiction at a reasonable speed is to just sort of open yourself up to what you're feeling, to not get in your own way of expressing those feelings, and to not give a crap about what anybody thinks about what you're about to write, and just like, just, you know, let it go. That works for me. And I think it, you know, I do write books very quickly. I have caught some flack about that from people in the past. But I kind of feel like my reviews speak for themselves. Readers tend to generally like my books quite a lot and to appreciate kind of the artistic side that I put into them. So I'm happy with that.
Yeah, and let's face it, at the end of the day, I've listened to some or read some stuff about, you know, more well-known writers of the literary type who basically either lie about how long things take, or, you know, or we just don't know. They, you know, they wouldn't necessarily tell us. But, you know, I know what you mean. I'm going to have to find some examples of famous books that were done really quickly, because there are a lot, and it's one of those odd things. I do want to ask you about outlining and story structure for a literary fiction novel. Given that you write genre fiction as well, what is the difference between your outline for a literary novel versus a historical genre fiction?
There's really not a lot of difference, to be honest. The only real differences come in sort of the front end of production. Like if you think of the outlining part as the back end, where you're sort of laying the groundwork, and the front end is all, you know, putting the trappings on that people are actually going to read. The main difference is there. It's stylistic differences. It's a different way of you know, choosing words and of formulating sentence and paragraph flow that just fits better with what that audience expects from their reading material. But in terms of structuring the story itself, it's really the same. And then also, I should point out, too, I still do write by the seat of my pants sometimes. Like, sometimes I just need a break from all that structure. And if it's a project that I don't expect to, like, make me a lot of money, and I don't expect to, you know, be one of the main breadwinners of my backlist, I'm perfectly happy to just give myself total creative freedom to, you know, screw it all up and spend 3 months or whatever writing a bunch of crap that's never gonna that's never gonna work, and delete it all and do something else. Because sometimes that's good for you, you know? So I do kind of let go of the outlining stuff once in a while and you know, just have fun with it. But like right now, for example, I'm working on a book that that a literary fiction publisher is considering, because that book will need to be done by a deadline if they decide to buy it. I am using an outline for that. So it is a literary novel, but it's structured. It's, you know, I've got all the groundwork in there so I can ensure before I spend much more time working on this project that it's going to, you know, hold together by the end of it. It's going to meet all the requirements for that genre. So, so I use it when I need to, which is most of the time, but sometimes I don't outline at all.
And I'm wondering, you know, because you have these varied publishing relationships, how do you decide, when you look at your coming year, for example, how do you decide what projects you're going to write, which you're going to do indie, which you might do traditional? How are you sort of planning that?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. I do, obviously, my first concern is I need to keep my bills paid. So I try to make sure that I have a nice, solid commercial project coming out under one pen name or another, at least every other month. And you know, I can intersperse the kind of less commercial stuff in there as needed, or maybe stuff that I'm trying to sort of get off the ground, but it hasn't proven itself yet and found its audience yet. So I make sure I have kind of sure things scheduled in regularly. I also make sure I have books coming out that will be easy to promote. So first in a series or standalones that relate very clearly to my other stuff that I've already got out there, so that I can have those nice funnels that kind of lead in toward products that I know are going to be profitable. So there's that. There's also, I also need to take into consideration, you know, what ideas are kind of nagging at me the most, like what really wants to be written the most next, because that's important. I have to feel, you know, some excitement, some level of excitement about what I'm writing, even if it's just like, this book's dirty and it's fun to write, you know, even if it's just something as simple as that, I need to enjoy it. Because otherwise I might as well just go back to, you know, working, shoveling poop for a living. So Which was all zookeeping was, by the way. Everyone's like, oh, you're a zookeeper. That must have been so cool. And I was like, honestly, it was literally 99% feces.
And presumably feeding, because that has to go in one end, so it comes out the other.
Yeah, that was a 1%. There's feeding, and all the rest is just poo all the time.
That is really funny. I do want to ask you about your goals, and because I find it really interesting. So you have other pen names, you write historical, you write literary, you have nonfiction. What are your goals as a writer now? Because I always feel like with literary, do people want to win prizes, for example? Do you want to win a prize as well as earning a living? You know, balancing earning a living versus literary work is really difficult. So, you know, what are your goals and ambitions as a writer?
My biggest goal and ambition is to win a major literary prize, and that is a totally separate goal and ambition from paying my bills, because, like, honestly, literary fiction just really doesn't pay. Like, it does for, you know, one or two authors at a time, and everybody else is just, like, floundering, and, you know, pretty much everyone who writes literary fiction either has a separate day job, or they write genre fiction as well, because there's just not a big enough audience there to make a living from it. So it's kind of weird that some of the most widely esteemed and widely recognized prizes in the world of literature go to literary fiction, which has the tiniest audience. It's so odd. I don't know why it is that way, but it is. And I just, like, unashamedly, I just want that feather in my cap. I would love to win a Pulitzer. I would love to win a National Book Award or an Orange Prize or something. So I'm just, like, viciously pursuing these literary awards. I don't know if I'll ever get them, especially, like, I'm kind of hobbled because my options are either I enter as a self-published author or as an author who's working with Amazon imprints. Like, either way, I'm reviled. So the likelihood that I'll ever actually win one of these prizes is slim to none. But I'm still trying anyway because I want to do it. So yeah, that's honestly, I mean, really the only reason, other than for just the enjoyment of self-expression, the only reason I bother to write literary fiction once in a while at all is so that I can have a chance at winning some awards. But
That's great. I think that's so good. And the fact that you also write to earn money as well is, you know, means it's very balanced. And I feel that a lot of literary fiction authors are not willing to write genre fiction. Do you sense that they're not willing to kind of, and we don't see any difference in value between, you know, them, but some people might say it's a step down for you to write genre.
There's the step down comes in, like, the way the publishing industry itself, including, like, the awards complex, values those genres, which is dumb and stupid, but it is what it is, and we can't really fight against it. But I recently made friends with an author because I just loved her book so much. I found her on Facebook and, like, fangirled on her. Her name's Natalie Capel. She's an amazing literary author. She's up in Canada. Absolutely, like, she blew my mind, which not many authors can do anymore because, you know, once you start writing for a living, you get very cynical and jaded about books, you know? But I couldn't put her book down. I could not stop reading it. I was so obsessed with it. And I talked to her a little bit online and I expressed that, like, you know, in some ways I'm very envious of her because she has sort of kept what she does pure, so to speak. I use giant air quotes around that because I think neither she nor I, and I'm sure you wouldn't either, we don't view it as a purity versus, you know, dirtiness issue to write literary fiction versus genre fiction. But the rest of the publishing world does tend to see it that way. Like, it's much more likely that you will be seen as a hack. You know, no matter how good your books are, you're a hack if you've, like, given in and sold out and written that stuff that sells, you know? But then on the other hand, a lot of authors who have kind of been careful to sort of guard their quote-unquote purity as literary authors, they really envy me because I'm making a living doing what I love and what they love, and they wish they could do that instead of having to go to the university and teach the creative writing courses all day long, or go work as a lawyer. You know, it's they really want to be writing too. So, like, we both have reasons to envy one another. And you know, if you're into literary fiction, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You know, all you can do is just do what feels right for you and trust that you're making the right decision for yourself. So,
yeah, and I wonder on that about the pen name thing, because you use Libby Hawker for a number of genres. What about writing, like, for example, presumably you could do literary fiction with a traditional publisher under another name.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you would, you know, in that way, keep it pure for the industry? Would you do that? So, I mean, I totally want you to have your ambition. I really do.
It's something I would definitely consider. If this particular publisher who's thinking about this book that I'm working on now takes it, I will have that conversation with them to see what they think. I'm not averse to the idea, but there's a part of me that is really stubborn and really averse to the idea on the inside, just because, like, who the hell do these ivory tower jerks think they are to tell me that I'm less of a writer because I also make people happy with my fiction? Well, I mean, let's be honest, like, if you read anything that has the Libby Hawker name on it, there's going to be some bad stuff that happens. Like, you know, be prepared for a bad ending. But, you know, I do write genre fiction because it's entertaining and because people like it and because it sells. Like, if somebody wants to judge me for that and decide that I'm, you know, not worthy of winning some big fancy award just because I have sold out in some respect, there's a big part of me that just wants to flip them the bird and be like, take me as I am, you know, take me or leave me. Like, either recognize that I'm a really good artistic writer and that I can also do this commercial stuff really well too and be successful as that, or don't take me at all. So I don't know, there may be a time in the future, like, if I really get rabid about wanting those prizes where I just come up with a totally different pen name and I don't tell anybody that's also secretly me. Or I may try to do this all under this pen name. We'll just see what happens.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I was just thinking there about, you know, Charles Dickens. Obviously, you don't want to be long dead by the time you become famous. Or, nope. You know, but, you know, considered literature, read as literature. But when he was writing, it was purely genre fiction serialized in newspapers. And he was hawking it. And then if you think that Stephen King, I mean, you know, when you think of characters and dialogue and, you know, real depth, Stephen King is a bit like Dickens in that way, in that he does these amazing characters and hugely popular, but I don't think Stephen King would ever win a Pulitzer or a, you know, if he did, it would be amazing because it would actually represent what people love, you know. Yeah. One of the most well-loved authors in the world, and I would prefer Stephen King to win it than James Patterson, for example. Both, you know, sold a lot of books, but I think King is a craftsman. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think certainly a lot of the authors who we revere now as being classics and as being, you know, the greats, they were just, yeah, they were writing serialized stuff that came out in popular magazines in their time. They were writing to a particular audience because it was commercial. My favorite example of that, I have two actually, Lucy Maud Montgomery, who wrote, of course, the Anne of Green Gables books. Love her. Her writing is so literary, so beautiful, so emotional. It's amazing. It absolutely stands up, you know, 100+ years later to anything that's being written now by anybody who's won a Pulitzer Prize. I mean, she was that good. And she was writing genre fiction back then because that's what she could write. That's what she could sell. Now it's revered as a very fine example of extra high quality writing, and it should be. But back in her day, she never would have won an award. Another good example is Louisa May Alcott, who wrote Little Women and several other books of that type. She always had an ambition to write for a living, and she got to a point where she needed to write for a living in order to help support her family. She wrote under a couple of secret pen names, and she wrote what they called lurid fiction. One of my favorites is one that's called The Passion of Polly, or maybe it's just Polly's Passion. But, you know, I mean, it was romance novels, except they weren't called romance novels back then. So she was a romance author, and eventually, you know, she kind of cut her teeth writing for that market and got to the point where she caught some, you know, editor's eye who was like, you're actually a really excellent writer. You should write some serious stuff. And he was, you know, the person who kind of got her the gig of writing Little Women. And she became famous for that. But even Little Women, again, was written as like this sort of morality play for the generation at the time. It was intended as genre fiction that was, you know, meant to be very commercial and was meant to appeal to this particular section of readerdom. And now it's of course a classic. So that's just, you know, that happens. I mean, I could list off like virtually every author now who has written a classic was just writing genre fiction at the time. And that's where our classics come from. And I think I think we are making some inroads slowly in, seeing stuff that was formerly considered purely genre fiction as having, more artistic merit. When Hilary Mantel won the Man Booker Prize back-to-back for the first two books in her historical trilogy, her Thomas Cromwell series, which is awesome. My favorite book ever. So people need to read it. Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. And then I am very impatiently waiting for the final book to come out, which was supposed to be out this year, but it's not. So she won back-to-back Man Bookers for those, and with good reason. I mean, they're absolutely astonishing works of art. They're fabulous. And they are also very compelling genre fiction. So I think we're starting to see a little bit of ground being yielded among the awards people. And you know, I think they're starting to recognize that, okay, yes, maybe genre fiction is popular and appeals to a wide audience, but that doesn't mean it also can't be, you know, a quality work of art. So I don't know. Maybe there's hope for me yet.
No, there is. And I think the best thing is to continue growing that body of work. And, you know, Hilary Mantel, everyone thinks Wolf Hall, but of course she'd written lots of books before that.
Yes.
And Wolf, I don't even know how many, but, you know, she's not a young writer and she's had lots of books. So I think we can all, I think it's very important. I'm so glad you stated your ambitions. I think it's so important for us to think longer term with our writing and to think, yeah. Okay, so how do we see ourselves in 20, 30 years time? You know, I look at Stephen King and I'm like, well, he's 68. I think he's 68. So I've got like 25 years or something before I'm at the point that he is in his career. So what can I create in the next 25 years so I'm worthy to be where he is at that point? So that's my take on it anyway.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's super important.
It is. So I had tons more questions for you, but we're out of time. So we might have to do a return visit sometime.
I would love to. Yeah.
Because that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed our chat. So where can people find you and all your books online?
Yeah, you can find my historical and literary fiction at libbyhawker.com. And it's spelled LIBBIEHAWKER. And you can also find my romance, if that's your thing, at libstarling.com, starling like the bird. And in July, I'll have a third pen name coming out with some urban fantasy. So you can stay tuned for that too, I guess.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Libby. That was great.
Thank you, Joanne.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.